The Thursday Murder Club is back, and they've got their hands on a cold case that's been haunting the seaside town of Fairhaven for a decade. Richard Osman's The Bullet That Missed follows our beloved septuagenarian sleuths as they tackle their most complex mystery yet. Since its release, this third installment in the series has captivated millions, spending over 30 weeks on bestseller lists and earning praise from celebrities like Reese Witherspoon, who called it the perfect blend of wit, intrigue, and heart. The novel's unique charm lies in how it combines a twisty murder mystery with profound observations about aging, friendship, and the unexpected adventures that can unfold in life's final chapters. As we dive into the investigation of TV journalist Bethany Waits' mysterious cliffside disappearance, we'll discover that in the world of the Thursday Murder Club, nothing is quite as it seems, especially when there's no body to be found. 10 years ago, promising young reporter Bethany Waits disappeared after her car plunged off Shakespeare Cliff, a treacherous stretch of Dover's coastline known for its dangerous curves and steep drops. Though investigators found blood spatter patterns and torn clothing fragments in the mangled wreckage, Bethany's body was never recovered from the churning waters below. Before her disappearance, Bethany had been meticulously investigating a sophisticated VAT fraud scheme involving phantom mobile phone transactions worth millions of pounds. Her reporting ultimately helped convict businesswoman Heather Garbutt, who received a 15-year sentence, while her suspected accomplice Jack Mason, despite substantial circumstantial evidence, managed to slip through the prosecution's net. For Joyce Meadowcroft, the newest and most enthusiastic member of the Thursday Murder Club, this cold case presents an irresistible double opportunity. Not only does she get to sink her teeth into an unsolved mystery, but it also provides a chance to meet her long-standing television crush, veteran news presenter Mike Waghorn, who had mentored Bethany during her early days at Southeast News. With characteristic ingenuity, Joyce orchestrates what appears to be a casual dinner meeting, ostensibly to interview Ron for a human interest story about retirement village life. Her carefully laid plan bears unexpected fruit when Mike, after several glasses of wine, brings up Bethany unprompted. Some new info came to light, Mike reveals, his hands trembling slightly as he shares a text message Bethany sent just weeks before her death. Can't say what, but it's absolute dynamite, getting closer to the heart of this thing. The message was timestamped 11:42 p.m., just days before her fatal plunge. This tantalizing clue sets the Thursday Murder Club on a collision course with enemies who have spent a decade believing their secrets were safely buried. The timeline they piece together becomes increasingly puzzling. Bethany left her flat in Canterbury at 10:15 p.m. on that fateful night, captured on her building's security camera. Her red Vauxhall Corsa then inexplicably vanished from all CCTV cameras along her usual route home, a four-hour gap that defies explanation. When the car finally reappeared on cameras near Shakespeare Cliff at 2:47 a.m., security footage captured what appeared to be two shadowy figures inside, though the grainy quality makes positive identification impossible. By dawn, her car was discovered crushed at the bottom of the cliff, with blood evidence suggesting serious injury, but no sign of Bethany herself. What transpired during those missing hours, and why would someone go to such lengths to silence a journalist investigating what appeared to be a straightforward tax fraud case? As Elizabeth, Joyce, Ibrahim, and Ron begin pulling at loose threads, they'll soon discover this case has tentacles reaching into places far darker and more dangerous than they initially imagined, including connections to organized crime syndicates and corrupt officials who would prefer the past stay buried. Elizabeth Best has faced countless adversaries during her distinguished 30-year career as an intelligence agent, but few have been as audacious or methodical as the one who orchestrates her and Stephen's abduction during their routine afternoon walk in St. James's Park. After being expertly blindfolded, bound, and transported through what Elizabeth estimates to be central London's back streets, she finds herself in an elegantly appointed study face to face with a man known only as the Viking. a cryptocurrency kingpin whose physical presence matches his digital reputation for calculated brutality. The Viking's ultimatum comes with clockwork precision. Kill Viktor Ilyich within 2 weeks, or I'll kill Joyce Meadowcroft myself. He delivers this threat while serving Earl Grey tea in bone china cups, a gesture of civility that makes the moment all the more chilling. The demand transforms what began as a methodical cold case investigation into a deadly game of psychological warfare. Viktor Ilyich, once feared as the Bullet during his legendary KGB career, represents a complicated figure in Elizabeth's past. Their relationship evolved from bitter rivalry during the Cold War to an unlikely friendship marked by mutual respect and possibly romance during the tumultuous post-Soviet years. Now operating as a traditional money launderer, Viktor has positioned himself as the Viking's primary business competitor, steering high-net-worth clients away from cryptocurrency channels and back to established banking networks. Elizabeth maintains her trademark composure, even as she assesses their dire situation. "I've had a fairly good run," she tells the Viking with characteristic dry wit. "I wouldn't mind dying in such a cozy room." Her eyes, meanwhile, catalogs every detail of their surroundings, from the first edition Dickens on the shelves to the slight Bulgarian accent in their captor's perfect English. The stakes escalate dramatically when Joyce's life enters the equation. Elizabeth must now navigate an intricate maze, protecting her closest friend, pursuing Bethany's decade-old murder, and outmaneuvering the Viking without sacrificing Viktor, all while dealing with arthritic knees and a heart condition that her doctor has repeatedly warned her about. The situation becomes even more labyrinthine when news arrives of Heather Gardbutt's murder in her maximum security prison cell. The victim leaves behind a haunting message scrawled in her final moments. "They are going to kill me. Only Connie Johnson can help me now." Connie Johnson, a notorious drug kingpin whose empire Elizabeth helped dismantle 5 years earlier, emerges as an unexpected ally in their investigation, bringing her street-level intelligence network into play as they race to connect the dots between Bethany's long-ago disappearance and the current spate of calculated killings. What elevates this storyline beyond a typical thriller is its unflinching examination of mortality through the lens of its elderly protagonists. Elizabeth and Stephen confront death not as some abstract future concept, but as an immediate, breathing threat. Their response, facing mortal danger, with a combination of hard-earned wisdom, dry humor, and surprisingly agile thinking, demonstrates that courage and resourcefulness aren't limited by age. Whether picking complex locks with arthritic fingers or using their presumed frailty to lull younger adversaries into fatal overconfidence, they prove that experience often trumps raw physical prowess in the deadliest of games. Following the money in Bethany's investigation leads the Thursday Murder Club down a rabbit hole of offshore accounts, shell companies, and suspicious transactions. With help from Joyce's financial expert daughter, Joanna, and her colleague, Cornelius, they uncover a crucial early mistake in the VAT fraud scheme. Payments to companies named Trident Capital, Trident Investments, and Trident Infrastructure International connect to a legitimate Jersey company called Trident Construction, with Jack Mason as its sole director, Cornelius explains during their Zoom call. Additionally, they discover two potentially fake identities, Karen Whitehead and Robert Brown, MSC, who received early payments from the scheme. Jack Mason's company also purchased Heather Garbutt's house after her arrest, raising questions about what might be buried on the property. When Ron meets Jack Mason for a game of snooker, the aging East End criminal admits to being involved in the VAT fraud with Heather, but denies any connection to Bethany's death. However, when pressed about whether Bethany is truly dead, Jack makes a chilling statement. "Oh, she's dead. I know that for a fact." Meanwhile, police officers Chris Hudson and Donna DeFrigis discover that Bethany's car disappeared from CCTV coverage because she likely visited Juniper Court, an apartment building with underground parking that allowed her to bypass cameras. Coincidentally, this is where Pauline Jenkins, the makeup artist from Southeast Tonight, has lived for years. As the financial investigation deepens, Ibrahim makes a breakthrough by recognizing that Karen Whitehead is an anagram of Catherine Howard, the name of the protagonist in Chief Constable Andrew Everton's crime novels. This seemingly insignificant connection will prove crucial as the team pieces together who might have had both motive and opportunity to silence Bethany permanently. The brilliance of this storyline lies in how it transforms something as potentially dry as financial fraud into a compelling mystery with real human stakes. Each transaction tells a story, each shell company hides a secret, and somewhere in this paper trail lies the truth about what happened to Bethany Waits. With the Vikings deadline looming, Elizabeth devises an audacious plan to fake Viktor Ilyich's death, a scheme that showcases both her strategic brilliance and the group's theatrical capabilities. She meticulously plans each detail, drawing on her decades of intelligence work to create a deception that would convince even the most skeptical observer. Elizabeth and Joyce travel to London under the pretense of confronting Viktor. In his luxurious Mayfair apartment, Elizabeth pulls a gun on Viktor with such conviction that Joyce, unaware of the plan, genuinely believes her friend has crossed a moral line. The performance is particularly crucial because the Viking, having cloned Elizabeth's phone, monitors their every communication and movement. Elizabeth later reveals to a shaken Joyce, "I needed your genuine reactions, method acting, if you will. He had to believe it was real, which meant you had to believe it was real." The intricate plan unfolds in careful stages. First, they destroy Elizabeth's compromised phone to prevent tracking. Viktor is given precisely measured sleeping pills, enough to make him appear lifeless but maintain his safety. Bogdan, their trusted ally, arrives with an oversized holdall specially chosen for its dimensions and discreet appearance. They time Victor's transport perfectly between CCTV camera sweeps, eventually releasing him in a carefully selected multi-story car park where surveillance is minimal. Joyce's flat, previously swept for surveillance devices, becomes their safe house. The Thursday Murder Club transforms the operation's final phase into a masterclass in forensic theater. In a freshly dug grave, arranged through Ibrahim's connections with a local cemetery, they stage the crucial photo shoot. Viktor lies naked, his body positioned to match typical execution-style killings. Pauline, drawing on her experience with theater makeup, creates a devastatingly realistic exit wound on Victor's forehead, complete with powder burns and tissue damage details that would convince even medical examiners. Ibrahim, usually more comfortable with psychological analysis than photography, takes multiple angles to ensure the perfect shot, while Elizabeth directs the macabre scene with the precision of a film director. "Stop smiling and close your eyes. You're supposed to be dead," she repeatedly instructs Viktor, whose natural charm keeps breaking through despite the circumstances. However, their carefully orchestrated deception unravels when the Viking's meticulous nature reveals their ruse. He discovers the telling evidence, a bullet hole in Viktor's ceiling rather than his head. His threatening messages to Elizabeth carry both fury and promise. "You have made a big mistake," and "the bullet that missed." The stakes escalate dramatically as the Viking, enraged by their attempt to fool him, now targets both Viktor and Joyce for elimination. This sequence brilliantly subverts expectations about elderly characters, demonstrating how age and experience can be powerful assets rather than limitations. The Septuagenarian sleuths orchestrate an operation worthy of international intelligence agencies. Combining Elizabeth's spycraft, Joyce's ability to play along, Ibrahim's attention to detail, and their collective understanding of human psychology, their success relies not on physical prowess, but on carefully honed skills, observation, planning, and the wisdom to know that sometimes the best weapon is a convincing lie. As the investigation progresses, unexpected personal connections emerge that complicate the case. Donna DeFreitas begins a relationship with Bogdan, Elizabeth's mysterious Eastern European associate. Their romance develops amid discussions of murder methods and police investigations, creating an unusual but touching bond. Why does this matter for everyday life? Donna wonders as she falls asleep in Bogdan's arms, feeling truly safe and content for perhaps the first time. Meanwhile, Ron Ritchie finds himself reluctantly drawn to Pauline Jenkins, the makeup artist who seems to know more about Bethany's case than she initially revealed. Their relationship begins with Ron's TV appearance and progresses through unlikely dates, including a couple's massage that Ron pretends to hate but secretly enjoys. Mike Waghorn's connection to Bethany proves deeper than professional friendship. In a poignant revelation, Mike shares that Bethany helped him come out as gay after hiding his sexuality his entire life. "She refused to let me feel shame," Mike recalls, explaining how her support transformed his life and allowed him to become more authentic and happier. Even the villains have unexpected dimensions. The Viking, initially presented as a ruthless assassin, reveals a more complex personality when Joyce engages him in conversation about cryptocurrency investments. And Connie Johnson, the imprisoned drug kingpin, develops a genuine therapeutic relationship with Ibrahim despite her threats to kill his friends once released. These personal connections create a rich tapestry of human relationships that elevate the novel beyond a simple whodunit. They remind us that even in the midst of murder investigations, life continues with its complications, joys, and surprising moments of connection. Perhaps most touching is Stephen's cognitive decline, which becomes increasingly apparent throughout the story. When Bogdan suggests they play chess near the end of the novel, Stephen reveals a devastating truth. "I've never been the chess player. Elizabeth was. I never got the hang of it." This heartbreaking moment captures the cruel reality of dementia while highlighting the dignity and courage with which Stephen faces his condition. As the pieces of the puzzle come together, the Thursday Murder Club realizes they're dealing with a mastermind who carefully engineered Bethany's disappearance and Heather's imprisonment. The breakthrough comes when Ibrahim discovers that Karen Whitehead is an anagram of Catherine Howard, a character from Chief Constable Andrew Everton's crime novels, while Joyce recognizes Michael Gullis as another name connected to the case. With this revelation, they devise an elaborate trap. Using Henrik's, the Viking's, mansion as their stage, they invite Andrew Everton to meet the Viking, supposedly a money launderer who could help him with the £10 million from his VAT fraud. Unbeknownst to Everton, the entire conversation is being live-streamed to millions through Fiona Clements' hacked Instagram account. "I have £10 million that needs laundering," Everton tells Henrik, offering $500,000 plus protection as a chief constable on your payroll. He explains how he conceived the scheme while writing a book and partnered with Jack Mason to execute it. When Henrik asks why they stopped, Andrew admits a journalist was getting too close and she died. Though he initially denies direct involvement in any murders, Victor, posing as Yuri, the Viking's associate, eventually extracts a full confession. "I murdered Bethany Waits." The brilliance of this setup lies in its understanding of human psychology. Elizabeth knew Andrew would confess because he needs the Viking's trust and has the ego to take credit for his crimes. By appealing to his vanity and greed, they create a situation where he essentially convicts himself before millions of witnesses. Mike Waghorn delivers the final blow with an impromptu broadcast honoring Bethany. "While this news will soon fade from public memory, I want everyone to remember her name long after Andrew Everton is forgotten." This public humiliation of a powerful figure represents a uniquely modern form of justice, one where social media exposure becomes as powerful as traditional law enforcement. It's a fitting conclusion for a case that began with a journalist seeking to expose the truth. The novel's title takes on multiple meanings as the story reaches its conclusion. Literally, it refers to the bullet hole in Victor's ceiling, the bullet that missed its intended target. Metaphorically, it represents the failed attempt to silence Bethany Waits and the truth she discovered. In a stunning twist, we learn that Pauline knew a secret about Bethany all along. Looking at the CCTV footage of two figures in the car and remembering Bethany's unflattering clothes that night, Pauline realized Bethany had faked her own death using a mannequin. She kept quiet because she knew Mike loved Bethany and would be devastated to learn she'd run away with stolen money without telling him. This revelation is confirmed when we meet Bethany herself, now living as Alice Cooper in Dubai. While investigating the VAT fraud, she learned enough about money laundering to not only track the money but access it herself. After Andrew Everton sent her a bullet, she realized he must have bugged her phone. Rather than fight him, she diverted his money into new accounts and faked her death using makeup, a mannequin, and her own blood. Though she has regrets about leaving Mike, what ultimately convinced her to disappear wasn't the bullet with her name, it was the bullet with Mike Waghorn's name scratched into it. This twist recontextualizes everything we thought we knew about the case. Bethany wasn't a victim, but a clever escapee who outmaneuvered her would-be killer and disappeared with £10 million. The two figures in her car were actually Bethany and a mannequin, and the blood found at the scene was her own, donated to sell the deception. Mike seems to suspect this truth. Every year on Bethany's death anniversary, he receives an email containing just a single red rose from an anonymous address. Though he tells himself it's just fantasy, he hopes that if the emails are from Bethany, she saw his recent broadcast tribute. The novel ends with several threads of justice. Andrew Everton sits in Belmarsh Prison, his clever schemes having led to his downfall. Though he believes he might escape murder charges, forensic evidence links him conclusively to Jack Mason's suicide. Meanwhile, Elizabeth considers investigating the Dubai connection, wondering if it might lead to Bethany. As Joyce swims laps in Victor's freezing pool while Ron and Ibrahim watch bundled in overcoats, Elizabeth questions swimming in such cold. Joyce wisely replies, "Ah, but we may not be," reminding Elizabeth to seize each moment. It's a poignant reflection on mortality and living fully, even as the Thursday Murder Club prepares for their next adventure. At its heart, The Bullet That Missed is a profound celebration of friendship in life's final chapters. The Thursday Murder Club members face dangers that would terrify people half their age, yet they do so with remarkable humor, unflinching grace, and unwavering loyalty to one another. Their bond transcends the typical social connections of retirement living, forging instead a deep alliance built on shared purpose and mutual understanding. When the Viking threatens Joyce with violence, Elizabeth doesn't hesitate to risk her own safety, drawing on decades of spycraft not just to solve a puzzle, but to protect someone she loves. This moment crystallizes the evolution of Elizabeth's character from lone operative to fierce protector. Similarly, Ibrahim's prison visits to Connie reveal the depth of his compassion. Despite her manipulation and threats, he persists in offering psychological insight and genuine support, believing in the possibility of redemption even in life's later chapters. The everyday moments prove equally powerful. When Ron struggles with his deteriorating knee, Pauline's quiet understanding comes without pity or judgment. She simply adjusts their walking pace and finds benches along their route. Stephen's advancing dementia challenges the group in profound ways, yet they maintain his dignity through small acts of kindness, finishing his sentences without drawing attention, gently redirecting his confusion, and including him in discussions even as his participation becomes more limited. These relationships aren't idealized. They're beautifully flawed, full of good-natured bickering, carefully kept secrets, and occasional manipulation. Joyce still won't reveal her banana bread recipe, Elizabeth withholds details of her past missions, and Ron continues to embellish his stories from his union days. yet these imperfections make their connections more authentic and deeply meaningful. In a society that often relegates the elderly to the margins, the Thursday Murder Club members have created a vibrant community where they remain vital, engaged, and profoundly valued. The novel's most touching revelation comes when Elizabeth, who has survived decades of international intrigue and maintained countless covers, realizes that Joyce has become her first true best friend. "I've never had a best friend," she admits with genuine wonder, discovering this fundamental human connection in her 70s. This moment underscores how it's never too late for meaningful personal growth. The group's gathering atop Shakespeare Cliff to honor Bethany's memory serves as a powerful testament to their collective strength. While questions about the case remain unresolved, they understand that the real mystery they've solved is how to live fully in their final years. Ron and Pauline's relationship deepens through small domestic details. His noticing her makeup in his bathroom speaks volumes about their growing intimacy. Victor, once isolated by his past, finds unexpected camaraderie at Cooper's Chase. Joyce continues her daily swimming routine with characteristic enthusiasm, embodying the group's determination to embrace life's remaining adventures. In an era fixated on youth, The Bullet That Missed offers a refreshing and nuanced perspective on aging. These characters don't retreat from life's challenges. They lean into them with wisdom, wit, and remarkable resilience. They take calculated risks, forge new connections, and find renewed purpose through both their investigations and their friendships. Their adventures serve as a powerful reminder that curiosity, courage, and human connection aren't bound by age, and that life's most meaningful chapters often unfold in its final pages.